This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Most antebellum U.S. naval officers actively opposed filibustering expeditions, but governmental equivocation and legal and political constraints forced them to find their own methods of suppressing expeditions that exacerbated sectional tension. Roger Bailey is a PhD candidate at the University of Maryland College Park. His dissertation is titled, A Crisis of Identity, Sectionalism and the U.S. Navy Officer Corps, 1819 to 1861, and studies how naval officers' beliefs about slavery, expansion, and northern and southern identity influenced their actions and the country's path towards civil war. The dissertation focuses on naval support for Liberia, the Mexican-American War, exploring expeditions, filibustering, and transatlantic slave trade suppression and the secession crisis. Roger, welcome to Preble Hall.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is in partnership with the SMH, Society for Military History, and we were going to interview you at the annual SMH meeting here that was supposed to be, what, 2-3 days ago. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, because of COVID-19, SMH had to cancel their annual meeting, but we appreciate the partnership that we've developed with them, and we appreciate that you've been able to talk with us about what you were going to be presenting. Roger, how did you didn't go straight to grad school, did you?
Well, I had a year off where I was working at the Civil War Trust, doing a lot more. My undergraduate work had focused a little bit more on like the early American Republic, and working at the Civil War Trust gave me a little more experience with the Civil War history and turned me a little bit more in this direction.
How did you get involved with history? How did you get interested in it, I should say?
I mean, it goes way back to when I was a kid, I would say. I think back in probably in Boy Scouts, I could trace it to when we like did a camp out at Antietam National Battlefield when they do their illumination, and they light a little luminary on the actual battlefield for every casualty of the battle. And there's not much like that like can do the same job of conveying the scale of some of these historical events like Civil War battles. I don't know, like ever since then I've had an interest in kind of understanding, you know, obviously what the world was like back then, and gradually as I've studied the Navy more.
How did you target the Navy to study in your dissertation?
My undergraduate research, I had written an honors thesis, actually, that used your book a little bit on Charles Stewart.
Oh, God. No, don't. Please don't. Don't.
I feel like someday I'll look back at all my early works that way. No, it was useful. And I was studying honor in the early Naval Officer Corps, and things like dueling officers, like sort of publishing pamphlets against each other and requesting courts of inquiry and courts martial and things like that to like validate their honor. And I got very interested in like officers in the early Navy as these very unique characters in American history, because they're disconnected, or they're very different from the people around them and the way they conceive of honor and their place in the world in that period. And they're different, you know, in many ways from naval officers today in terms of where they're coming from, how they're trained, how they're socialized. So I started studying honor, and then I realized as I was doing some later research how similarly interesting and sometimes idiosyncratic some of these naval officers could be when it came to issues like slavery and sectionalism. And in particular, Matthew Maury, who is usually known as being the father of oceanography, I stumbled across some other research that has talked about the way he essentially organized like a secret pro-slavery exploring expedition to the Amazon rainforest in the 1850s and the Amazon River Valley, and got sort of proteges and friends of his to lead this expedition. And it was all done under the pretense of just commercial development, but they had actual secret instructions from him to look at the possibility of creating slave colonies in the Amazon.
Were there other naval officers involved in this?
Or just friends of his? Yeah, there were other naval. So he organized this expedition, like lobbied for it with the Secretary of the Navy, and got the officer commanding the expedition. He got his brother-in-law and friend William Lewis Herndon. Some of your listeners may know from the Herndon Monument at the Naval Academy. But before he famously went down with his ship, he led this Amazon expedition with another protege of Maury, Lardner Gibbon, I believe, who's not as famous or notable after the fact. yeah, so they had this expedition. They came back. They wrote up all of their stuff, that all their reports that talked about things like the price of slaves and the suitability for growing cotton and tobacco, the government's amenability to immigration, and published it as an official government report that was widely distributed and very popular in the broader reading public, and had this like stamp of legitimacy from the federal government. And it really emphasized to me how naval officers in this period who are acting with a lot of autonomy, because they're so far from Washington, they're expected to just make decisions on their own. It just emphasized how if you let these individuals make whatever decisions they want, like their own personal beliefs and ideas about the world are going to shape those decisions. And I decided to look at how their beliefs about slavery influenced them.
Well, when you look at somebody like Herndon or Maury and what they're doing in the Amazon, it almost seems to be the opposite of what the Navy is doing in West Africa in the 1830s during support for missions to
Liberia.
Right.
Yeah,
because they're real. And when you read the records, letters from the Secretary of the Navy and all these letters that are coming back about how they're stopping by these ports in West Africa to support the 80 or 100 or 200 shipped from the United States back to form these colonies.
That's actually, so that was the premise that I sort of had when I started this dissertation, is how do you reconcile these two different things? And there's other things we could lump into this sort of discussion, like the slave trade, and slave trade suppression and things like that, and filibustering suppression, like we'll talk about, where they have sort of similar pro or anti-slavery implications. I had gone into this thinking that I would be finding this split that existed where you had officers who were pro kind of colonizationism, Liberian settlement, and if not abolitionists, at least sort of loosely anti-slavery. And you'd find these officers that were pro-slavery and envisioning these other colonies, and that divide, as the nation moved towards civil war, that divide would grow until secession happened and the officer corps actually split. But what I've been finding more of, and what I hopefully when I've finished writing the dissertation, I can show more definitively, but what I'm finding is that they're actually very similar impulses. And that a lot of these officers are actually in the same little clique. Like Maury has his own little clique of officers at the Naval Observatory that, you know, he's sending on this mission. But he also, one of his close friends is another officer named William Francis Lynch, who leads another exploring expedition to Liberia specifically to support colonization. And he writes another book that is sort of pro-Liberia, where he dedicates it to Maury as a friend. They actually have sort of similar ways of looking at the world. They're all, I would argue, are sort of moderates at the time. Very few actual abolitionists and very few who are like radically pro-slavery. And all of them see slavery in the U.S. as unstable in the long term. And so they're looking together for external solutions to the problem. And some of those are a little more pro-slavery and some of them are a little more anti-slavery. Colonization itself can be called actually pro-slavery, arguably, since a lot of people are using it to support slavery by getting rid of free blacks in the South who they think are going to destabilize the institution. I guess what I think it demonstrates is actually almost a commonality that exists among some of these officers, where they don't necessarily see these ideas in conflict with each other. They see themselves trying to solve this problem of, like, we can't have a free America with black people because America needs to be white in their minds. And as long as there are black people here, there will be this internal contradiction. So certainly you can't have free black people in America. So they're trying to reconcile that.
Now, that was a lot of that came out of what Philadelphia with the American Anti-Slavery Society, was it? And there were some chaplains, and there were some Navy chaplains involved with that as well. Did you...
Oh, the Colonization Society?
That was it. Did you find that... did you look at the chaplains as well, or were you simply looking at the officers, the commission officers?
So I've focused on line officers. So I've looked there. I have dealt a little bit with a few other officers, and there were a lot of line officers very heavily involved in the Colonization Society. Robert Stockton is the best example, who actually is, I think he's the president of like the New Jersey chapter of the American Colonization Society, speaks at colonization events and things like that. And eventually he leaves the Navy and goes into politics, but he winds up running for president, actually.
And killing a number of cabinet officials, Princeton, you know, we all have our days, I guess.
He's most famous for that. Princeton incident. But there's also, I think there's at least one chaplain who writes a book about the slave trade suppression and colonization in Africa too. So that's,
was that Reverend Charles Stewart? Not the Commodore Charles Stewart, but the Reverend Charles Stewart.
I'm not familiar with that name. I think I want to say the name I'm thinking of is like Rockwell or something like that.
Well, let's get back to the crux of the issue that we're going to cover today. And who were the filibusters or the filibusteros?
So they're a very motley crew. Some of them, they really come from both from all parts of the country, north and south. They come from different classes. Some of them are like middle class college student and more educated Americans who sort of don't know exactly what they're going to do or have sort of an adventuring impulse. Some of them are displaced workers, people who have gone prospecting, 49ers and people like that who find themselves in California, can't get gold and need to find something else to do. Some of them are like expatriates from Europe, especially from the 1848 revolutions. And what they all tend to have in common is that they are a little bit untethered in this period. And of course, the antebellum era and the market revolution creates this issue a lot in society of like a larger group of like untethered young men. Some of them buy into this and have these visions of manifest destiny that extend even beyond the sea to shining sea image of going to California. And they start getting these aspirations of taking American institutions south and potentially getting rich in the process.
Does this start emerging during a particular decade?
No, actually. So we think about it mostly in the 1850s because there's a particular brand of it. And that's what I'm studying here, really. There's a radicalization, you could argue, that happens in the 1850s. It starts to become more sectional and like Southern and pro-slavery over the 1850s. But it starts, it goes back to Aaron Burr and even earlier. Like we didn't use the term as a nation really until the 1850s, but there are cases, there's filibustering against Canada in the 1830s and filibustering into Spanish Florida. So as long as there's been land that Americans could take from their neighbors, there have been people who have been willing to do it.
Did you find that these filibusters or do you want to use the term filibuster or filibustero? What's appropriate?
I use filibuster. Filibustero is the Spanish one, but you know that's okay. Still.
Was there a goal that they had in mind? Would you say in your studies that they were more focused on establishing a mini empire for themselves, or establishing a mini empire that adhered to a particular ideology with them as the head of that?
It's difficult to say, because obviously in their rhetoric they emphasize that second goal as a way of recruiting people and of legitimizing themselves to supporters who are going to fund them and provide them political support. Their actions tend to suggest that they're not they don't always have the most noble intentions. So I would tend to put them in that camp, especially the leaders. But there are certainly examples of them at least using that rhetoric of having larger ideals. And I guess I would say that they're more often than not, they were using the rhetoric of idealism. And even if they might have actually sort of envisioned that also, there was a clear demonstration or a clear interest in self-gain, especially among rank and file filibusters, but even among the leaders, and a lack of respect for the people who they were supposedly liberating.
Were former naval officers, did they become filibusters?
I have not personally encountered a case where that actually happened. I have at least one example where an officer like basically signed up for an expedition and then got cold feet. There were certainly sailors, especially a lot who deserted when they were out in California, who became filibusters. But I haven't seen a lot of examples of officers that actually carried out an intention to filibuster.
How does the U.S. Navy and its officer corps get involved with the filibusters?
So the government has a hard time stopping these expeditions. It's the law.
By the way, who funds these expeditions?
Usually a lot of Southerners in particular, they're almost all Democrats. They tend to be, you know, like prosperous donors, sometimes like merchants and planters and things like that. It's a varied group. I mean, like New York is also a hub of funding, so you're going to have more like business interests funding it there. But my impression is that they're mostly private individuals funding it.
Was there a reason given for them to support these?
Yeah, so a lot of them envisioned that this was going to create economic opportunity. So the same way that actual, like, individual men who decided to enlist and fight, there are different groups, I guess, of supporters. There were some of them who were diehard young Americans and would advocate in support of these expeditions, lobby, use their government roles in support of these expeditions because they genuinely wanted to see further American expansion because they believed it would be for the good of the country, in particular acquiring land that Americans could occupy and develop. A lot of the dialogue that goes on around this is centered on the idea of development, like that these Hispanic peoples who live in these lands aren't actually using them adequately, and, you know, good old Anglo-Saxon white people can come in and actually make use of these lands, and it will be in everyone's interest to develop them. There's a lot of people who have that broader ideology, and then there are people who have specific interests in the idea that by doing this they can acquire roles in this new government and sort of glory or honor from that, or that they can acquire actual land or land grants that they can then become essentially a planter in this new area or own a gold mine or something like that. So it's a mixture of ideology and practical, like, monetary interest.
Why does the Navy get involved with the filibusters?
So it's hard for the government to stop them. The federal government in this era is pretty weak to begin with when it comes to law enforcement. There's no FBI or anything like that. It's just kind of the Marshal Service is really the main entity that can do that. Filibustering is illegal under an act called the Neutrality Act, but it's a pretty weak law. It really only matters. You have to be able to demonstrate that someone was overtly committing an act to fight a war or prepare to fight a war with a neutral country on U.S. soil or within U.S. territory to be able to prosecute them.
And this is the Neutrality Act of 1818?
Well, so it starts with, there's a Neutrality Act of, I think, 1794, and it gets renewed and things are constantly tacked on. There's another one in, I think, 1807, and then 1818 is the big one, really clarifies this and tries to give it a little bit more teeth. And then I think there's another one in maybe 1838 that I think.
So Congress gets involved because they're identifying a problem of filibusters and these Americans who are going to different territories to establish themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah, and this starts in the very early Republic when America is getting pulled into all these foreign conflicts, and they want to discourage Americans from things like privateering for foreign powers during the French Revolutionary Wars. They want to prevent people from getting involved in the revolutions in Central and South America against the Spanish. And so that's where this initially comes from, and to preserve peace on the Canadian border, but they just never give it the teeth that it really needs. And the fact that often, even if they'd given it more teeth, it's not clear how much it would have done because the public was sympathetic. And so even when someone actually manages to catch someone in the act and bring them to trial, you more often than not, there'd be a hung jury, a mistrial, some case of, like, basically jury nullification, where even though they were obviously the defendant was obviously guilty, the jury just refuses to convict them. So the government can't easily stop them on U.S. soil, but they have to rely more and more. So more and more of them actually get off and get underway and leave the country, and then there's simply no one else at all to stop them besides the Navy after that point.
Now, one of the more famous filibusters is William Walker.
William Walker has this. He's most famous for his filibustering in Nicaragua, but, like, he has this sort of earlier expedition that's inspired by still earlier filibusters into northwestern Mexico. Walker gets it in his head that he can do this too. So he leads an expedition from California, a small town, not even town, really a ranch in northwestern Mexico called Ensenada in, I believe, Baja California. And has what most historians after the fact think of as kind of the dress rehearsal for his later expeditions. He decides that he declares himself president of Baja California, and then determines that he's going to expand to the neighboring province of Sonora, and then declares himself president of the Republic of Sonora. For several months has this armed party running around northwest Mexico until poor planning and lack of supplies and the Mexican military force him out. And the Navy plays a large role, actually, in bringing that about.
How do they do that?
So the Navy does quite a few things, and I actually find this one of the most interesting cases of naval filibustering suppression because it demonstrates little bits of all of the things that are going on in the different expeditions. Because there's just one single ship really that's there. There's like a small little relief vessel or store ship in San Francisco that doesn't get involved, but mostly it's just the USS Portsmouth under a commander named Thomas Dornan, and that's basically it. Like, that's the Navy's presence in Southern California while this expedition is going on. And the department in Washington sends him instructions to do something about this, but they're very vague. He has no real idea what the legal constraints on him are, and he has to figure out how, without like invading Mexico or running around arresting people on U.S. soil, which the U.S. military can't exactly do under normal circumstances, he has to figure out how to stop them. And so he uses a variety of techniques. He basically fights like a public relations battle in the press that involves some of his, at least one, possibly two of his subordinates writing letters that make the filibusters look bad.
They're writing in the newspapers about this?
Yes, yeah.
And now are they writing under their own names?
One of these things, the most damning to the filibusters, I would argue, like the most damning letter, is written anonymously. But as a historian, if you read it, it's, and you have a general understanding of what was going on, it's pretty clear it has to be his purser. It was a guy named Levi Slam. And he's a fascinating character that I could do almost a whole podcast episode just on him.
What's most interesting about him?
So he had formerly been a newspaper editor and radical like labor activist and Democrat in New York City. And then he becomes a purser in the Navy and gets shipped out here. And so he has this, in some ways, like a connection with the filibusters, because ideologically he's a member of this Democratic faction that is very young American, that has also has some expansionist ideas that makes him naturally sort of sympathetic to them. But he also has this experience writing provocative newspaper articles and things like that, and doing media relations, that makes him a very useful tool for the Navy. And it's not clear, he is like specially dispatched to this ship around the time that the Navy Department finds out that this expedition is going down.
That begs the question, do you think that they specifically sent somebody like this out there to handle the issue under the auspices of serving as the purser on the ship, which is essentially the supply officer?
I have not seen direct evidence, and so I'm like a little wary of speculating it, but it seems possible. Certainly people in California at the time thought that, like, there are newspaper reports at the time that thought this was the case. But it also seems possible. I'm trying to figure out exactly when the ship's previous purser left, and I haven't been able to find an account of that, because I'm trying to figure out. It might have been that they just needed to be sending him out there anyways, and he happened to be the right person at the right time. But it would not surprise me at all to find out that he was sent specifically because he had this useful skill set.
What else does Thomas Dornan, the captain of the USS Portsmouth, do with regard to the filibuster, and specifically to William Walker and his crew?
Yeah, so the very first thing he does is he sails for Ensenada, lands, anchors off the coast, and sends some officers ashore to meet with Walker. And they have a short meeting. It's a little bit contested by different accounts what happens at the meeting, but it seems like they have a very open discussion that would suggest that the filibusters did not see the Navy actually as their enemy, because the filibusters just discuss all of the intelligence the Navy could possibly want to know, like what their troop dispositions are, how many people they have, their supply situation, how many wounded men they have, the native hostile tribes, different local groups that were hostile and more well-disposed to them, their future plans, everything. They just tell the Navy everything about this. So it seems like the officers, which included Slam, who went ashore, seems like they were able to be on pretty good terms with these guys. But Dornan turns around and he immediately sends all this information to the army in San Francisco, which is trying to stop Walker's supporters there. And he sends it to the Commodore and to the Secretary of the Navy, and then immediately sets about trying to stop them. Walker actually, after this meeting, he leaves. He had plans to invade Sonora, and so he goes and does this. Or sorry, Dornan is able to, like, Walker leaves some of his wounded behind, and the guards abandon them, and so Dornan, like, takes them, rescues them, which makes it look to some observers like he's helping the filibusters, but he brings them back up into California, where they spread their story about how Walker abandoned them, and that makes Walker look bad. He lands troops in San Diego and has them, like, drill openly after he's made it known that he's going to stop the filibusters, and that seems to turn the main newspaper in San Diego against Walker. And he actually starts arresting people when local non-federal officials ask him to intervene.
What happens to Walker after this? Does he get captured at this point? Because he ends up going to Nicaragua at some point.
Yeah, so basically, Walker's expedition fails. He already was low on food and needed reinforcements. And because I should also mention that Dornan continues his blockade as all this other stuff is going on. So, like, because he can't get them by sea, and there's very few that trickle across the land all the way to him, he's not able to get reinforcements. He's not able to get food, and he has widespread desertion problems. And at some point, he just doesn't have the critical mass to fight anymore. And so he, in the face of, like, Mexican resistance from militias, I believe some actual troops, he winds up fleeing into California, strikes a deal with the army that he will sort of surrender to them and then go turn himself in to the authorities in San Diego. You know, sent there, sent to San Francisco, tried, nothing happens. He gets off free, becomes a newspaper editor again. And starts planning his next exit. I would actually say that there was not a lot of sectionalism in the way officers reacted to this. Like, if I'm looking at what officers are doing, I think that often it appears that officers allowed sympathy for filibusters to like make them go easy on the filibusters or crack down on them. But actually, it doesn't. I haven't noticed that. I haven't seen a correlation between who is Southern and who is pro-slavery and who cracked down on this. I think, on the whole, officers, even if they were expansionists or pro-slavery, they tended to see filibustering as a little bit destructive. It got in the way of things like actual annexation attempts with Mexico and with Cuba. And so, on the whole, I think they mostly opposed it, but they varied in how they tried to find ways of opposing it, given that the administration in Washington was usually a little bit ambivalent in their instructions, sympathetic, and, you know, and didn't give officers a lot of guidance or tools to do that.
Now, you're dealing with a decade largely in the 1850s, where you now have an established Naval Academy producing not naval officers, but you also have the legacy officers of the pre-Naval Academy era. Did you find a difference between those two groups?
So my research has mostly looked at officers who were acting in command of vessels or squadrons and things like that. So
the academy would have been too junior at that point.
Yes. Right? I will say I have the people, the officers who I have encountered who have been most sympathetic to filibusters were often younger. So there's one lieutenant who probably was a naval. I should look into that. He was probably a Naval Academy graduate on Dornan's ship. who was supposed to like basically give a threatening message to Walker, but Dornan writes later in a report that he was too engrossed, is the word Dornan uses. He was too engrossed with Walker to actually give him this threatening message, which I would interpret maybe as sympathy. It's hard to say. I know there's some other research that's been done on sort of the Pacific Squadron and filibustering and how the Navy felt about it that has argued that younger officers were more sympathetic. Certainly more younger officers tended to be more young American and had more sympathy.
There's a quote by Lieutenant Robert Shufeldt. If every enthusiast is to pursue his cause uncheckered, then the stability of all human institutions is at an end, unquote. Do you think that represents the difference in the mentality between the junior officers and the senior officers in how they're approaching the filibusters? Is there a generational difference?
Yes. So Shufeldt might, I'm not sure that I would put him in that older generation, but I think certainly that sentiment is the sentiment of the older generations. When you look at the people who were like commodores in this era, most of them tended to have this idea that there's just like kind of a sense of lawlessness that needs to be stopped because it will just cause chaos and get in the way of real progress. And maybe the fact that the Mexican-American War helped realize these dreams of expansion in a regulated, government-sanctioned way made some of them think it was unnecessary. Certainly, there were still these attempts to negotiate this acquisition going on, and so a lot of officers were bothered by the expeditions interfering with that. So I would also add that this is an era where sectionalism is really kind of peaking after the Mexican-American War, after the Compromise of 1850 and the Fugitive Slave Act creates a lot of resentment for slavery being sort of forced on the North. It's an era when things like the violence in Kansas really polarize people and the caning of Charles Sumner. And so officers who were younger in that area, I suspect, growing up in a more divisive time made them a little bit more polarized themselves. And I think that could explain part of that trend. Certainly, there's been some research that's shown that when the war actually breaks out, younger officers were more willing to resign. And some of that might have been for ideological reasons, although it's hard to say how much is that and how much is officers having put more time into their careers by late stage in their life and stuff. So it's a little bit hard to gauge, but it seems like there's at least some generational divide, and probably the people who were in the Naval Academy in the 1850s, had more sectional leanings and were more sympathetic to filibusters.
Earlier you mentioned the use of newspapers by Captain Thomas Dornan and his purser, but you also talk about the media attacks on the naval officers themselves, which I was surprised by. Can you discuss that a little?
Yeah, so especially as, like I said, sectionalism becomes more divisive in the country, having everything the federal government does is coming under more scrutiny. All of these cases, because there's this sort of legal ambiguity about how and when the Navy should be able to intervene to enforce law against Americans, it creates this sort of subjective debate that really inflames Southerners in particular who are ramping up in this fight over states' rights. I mean, there's a few reasons, but that's one of the big ones. And so maybe the most pronounced case happens in 1849 at Round Island, Mississippi. There's a naval officer, a small little squadron, really, that's involved in blockading a filibustering expedition. And the officers in that squadron who are openly writing in the press and taking stances to try to prevent this expedition from leaving the U.S., they're like the people of Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and the whole Deep South, like the press is really hostile to them. This is the federal government stopping American citizens acting on American soil, and they shouldn't be doing this. And especially because they're sort of pro-slavery and ideologically, you know, democratic and kind of aligned with the South, they are very hostile to naval officers acting in that way. And you see similar things in any other case where if the Navy takes a bold stance against filibusters, makes it look like the federal government is intervening against American citizens, either on American soil or on foreign soil outside of U.S. jurisdiction.
But what seems to be different with this is that the media is going and targeting the officers. They're not generalizing about the government or the Navy or the ship. They're actually going after the officers themselves.
Yes, yeah. And it's I think partly because the administration in general is very hands-off in dealing with this. I mean, this isn't unique. Like, this is an era when, because officers have so much autonomy, they are sort of making these decisions on their own. So if you look at cases like some of the punitive raids that officers launch against foreign peoples who are accused of piracy, if you look at the bombardment
Sumatra.
Yeah, exactly.
Kuala Batu, right.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at, like, the bombardment of Greytown, also in the 1850s by Hollins, I think, you see sort of similar public commentary about the officers as the decision makers here, because, you know, they're like sent to the far side of the world or somewhere far from Washington, and they're expected to make the calls about what's going on. And you see it maybe more with filibustering than some of these other cases because of the sectional nature of the issue, I would say. But in some ways, it's not super unique that it's just because these officers are left on their own. And they're left on their own especially with filibustering where the administration has no incentive to weigh in. Like these are popular expeditions in large parts of the country. They don't need to alienate their constituents. And if they can just – if the officials can put the blame on naval officers and just leave the responsibility with them, they're in no rush to like micromanage this policy. They're more than happy to sit back and you know, just wait until things are already decided before they decide how to get involved.
Roger, I'm going to mention a few of the naval officers that you discuss in your dissertation, and they're individuals who became midshipmen in the 20s or 30s, 1820s or 1830s. They are serving as commanding officers now, and some of them will become admirals during the Civil War. So as I go through these names, could you just briefly share a few thoughts on who they were and why they relate to the filibustering issue? I'm going to start with Commander Victor Randolph.
So Victor Randolph has two main areas where he's involved in filibustering. He's, he starts out, I think when this happens, as like a lieutenant. He's the commander by the end. He stops this Round Island, Mississippi expedition that's, you know, a bunch of filibusters planning to invade Cuba under Narciso Lopez. He blockades them. He writes for the press, publishes, like, issues proclamations against them, and ultimately is able to, like, wait them out, and they wind up dispersing. But then he very interestingly turns around, and when another party of Lopez's filibusters actually invades Cuba, fails, and is captured, when another party of filibusters is captured by Spanish officials and is held in Cuba, Randolph actually, negotiates for their release and threatens violence, basically threatens war against Spain to secure the release of these filibusters into American custody. So he's very interestingly, he kind of represents the weird conflict that goes on with officers where they're supposed to be stopping filibusters and they're supposed to be protecting American citizens from foreign governments at the same time.
You've mentioned Thomas Dornan. What happens to Thomas Dornan after this decade?
Randolph, to go back to him, I believe is actually involved in the very sketchy surrender of a Pensacola, I think, or a southern naval base to Confederates when the Civil War breaks out.
Where do you think, based on your research, your next phase will take you in this dissertation as you complete it? What are you hoping to find out?
So I'm very interested in finding out exactly what fault lines, if any, existed in the Naval Officer Corps. It doesn't seem like sectionalism is as pronounced as I thought, but clearly there's a fault that develops when secession happens, and some of the officers, you know, I think at least a quarter or maybe closer to a third of the officers leave to join the Confederacy. My goal is to get a sense of how these officers, like, related with each other and whether they had pockets of shared identity and shared ideology that were able to withstand the test of all of this division leading up to the Civil War. And, you know, that might actually shed a little bit of light on how a governmental organization, and especially how the Navy, how socialization can help, like, preserve unity, preserve nonpartisanship amidst really divisive times.
Well, I have to say in conclusion that having read what little of your dissertation I have, I think it's an extraordinary piece. I think it's great scholarship. I'm looking forward to the completion of your dissertation and seeing it in a more complete form. Roger Bailey, thanks for joining us on Preble Hall. We really appreciate it, and good luck to you, and stay safe.
No, it was a pleasure being here. Thank you.
And to our listeners, if you enjoy the episode, please leave feedback on any platform you listen to this, and hold fast. This too shall pass.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.